highbrow drivel of the highest order. An absolute disgrace.
That's some good highbrow.
Well, I never. Absolute drivel, I do say, my goodness. Now that's some good ass highbrow drivel, you hear me?
Conspiracy theories. Where do they come from, and why the hell would anyone believe them? In our latest episode, we're joined by senior psychologist Dr. Daniel Jolly and my good friend Juan Miles to discuss exactly that. One of the weird things about this year has been I feel like there are more conspiracy theories in the mainstream than ever before. And so I think it's a really great opportunity to talk about and talk to somebody who actually does work understanding how these things come to light and why people find them so appealing. And I think before we get into that, Juan, what's the craziest conspiracy theory you've heard this year?
Oh, this year?
Yeah. We'll start small and then get big later.
Well, I don't want to go with like two localized ones, but like my family back in Argentina have like all sorts of conspiracy theories about how COVID is just like a hoax in the same way that you hear like all over the world. But then they point the perpetrators of these hoax are like the Argentinian government all of a sudden. So it's kind of weird. It's like a global thing, but somehow it's all like the entire world is burning down just so the Argentinian government can screw them over. You know, it's like such a weird way to go about it.
It is funny as well, because that was one of the things I found so funny about QAnon's version of COVID being a whole thing to oust Trump and give him a bad name was a theory I saw. And it's like, oh, wait, so the rest of the world is shutting down too because of you. And I get that coming from Americans a little bit where the ego's a bit higher, but Argentina, got to check yourself.
Yeah, well, we are arrogant assholes though, so...
My favorite is still just, I realize it, and this is how fast this stuff moves. It's dated already, but the idea that 5G was causing COVID, I found ridiculous, particularly because people still believe that. And like in the UK, people were destroying 5G towers after New Zealand had already like had zero cases. And it's like, no, they've got 5G and don't have COVID. So you're going to have to reevaluate your statement here.
I don't feel like these people usually evaluate in the first place, let alone reevaluate. So
with the 5G one, that's such an interesting conspiracy theory. And indeed, when you mentioned the most kind of wacky, I thought of that one. But that one's been around for quite some time. But of course, it was never linked to COVID until COVID came a thing. It's been linked with different illnesses, etc., that has been debunked. But that kind of rhetoric already existed. So when COVID came into our lives and people were trying to understand what has caused this outbreak, 5G was already kind of a potential scapegoat for it. So people were naturally straight away talking about 5G being related. And unfortunately, due to the algorithms on Facebook, people talking about 5G in this way, the algorithms thought it was a trending topic. So they brought it up to the trending pages and suddenly it came kind of more mainstream than it has ever been before, which is an interesting role of social media, really.
It's also the way that conspiracy theories evolve and their etymology is not ever looked at is something I find really fascinating, because 5G is one great example of that. And I briefly mentioned QAnon earlier, and QAnon, it feels, is a natural evolution of like the Pizzagate thing, right? It feels like these discussions that are happening in silos for a long time get this new narrative that really drives the mainstream. And people don't go, well, hang on a second. We all thought that was ridiculous 2 years ago when we heard about it as this. How come this is now a thing that we're talking about or treating with any legitimacy?
I think that's a great point. And I think it's worth noting, as you say, that like the 5G and also QAnon have been around for a very long time. QAnon has been with us since 2017 when Trump first went into office. So it's not necessarily a new conspiracy theory. In a way, it's got more attention. Potentially, because of the kind of foundations of COVID, people are already hypervigilant, looking out for conspiracy narratives as a way to kind of understand the complex world. And we also know from the literature that conspiracy theories do kind of flourish around elections. And indeed, they flourish around any kind of large, significant event that can be a little bit anxiety-provoking. So it can be a virus outbreak, but it also can be elections. So in 2020, we've had both a virus outbreak and an election, which means that there's a fertile ground for conspiracy narratives. So when people are suggesting a whole host of different conspiracy theories, they're kind of hitting much more harder because of that kind of foundation that we find ourselves in. But I do predict that if COVID wasn't a thing in 2020, we still would have had conspiracy narratives about Trump and QAnon, etc. They just may not have been as highly talked about in the media, because of course conspiracy theories have been popular for a very long time. Polls demonstrate that in America, for example, over half the population believe at least one conspiracy, and this data is from 2018. These narratives have always existed. What's different this year, I think, is that the media are talking about them more. It's not a new thing to believe in conspiracy theories. It's just that the reporters are more interested in talking about them this year.
I love that there is this kind of Kong versus Godzilla shit fight of a superstorm that makes such fertile ground for conspiracy theories this year. One other thing that you didn't mention that I'm super curious as to your opinion on, Daniel, is that something I've noticed recently is a lot of my friends who I've seen posting about this stuff for the first time this year, I find it interesting that they've never mentioned it before. And I wonder, do you think there's any element to which, I'm gonna word it in the bluntest way, but I only mean the softest form of what I'm saying. These people are cowards, and the fact that they don't have to look people in the eyes at work in the morning means they're more comfortable spouting it on the internet behind a screen.
Oh, that's an interesting take. Okay, that's interesting. Something I've never actually thought about, I suppose, in that kind of regard, as in essence, having the comfort of being in your echo chamber, being at home, that you can kind of say whatever you want. And I do think that point mentioned about COVID being a fertile ground for conspiracy narratives can help with that, because, you know, the virus can make us all feel anxious, all feel perilous, all feel threatened. And these are some of the key predictors of why someone believes in a conspiracy to start with. In a very complex event, a conspiracy explains it in a very simple way. And that actually is really appealing. So if you're having these emotions and you're trying to, in essence, try and deal with these emotions, it can offer kind of a scapegoat. So with 5G being linked with COVID, it's not only a scapegoat, well, the reason we've got COVID is because of those 5G towers, but it also offers a way to stop COVID. If we burn down those towers, COVID goes away. So actually, for someone in that moment, that actually could be really appealing. So potentially, then going to their social media and actually talking about this narrative could be a real positive step. I'd be really interested to see if those people will talk about it in real life, in person. It's hard to say for certain, but I see conspiracy theories as a way of coping with our complex world. And that's why conspiracy theories arise during moments of crisis. And indeed, we are in a moment of crisis.
So just on that, in terms of the burning it down thing, one thing that I find interesting is, like, obviously having this element of feeling like you have a superior knowledge and a superior agency to other people around you. I understand how that's like an appealing thing on a human level. What I find interesting is the way, as kind of Juan mentioned at the top, is like, maybe if you didn't evaluate in the beginning, it's hard to reevaluate. But in light of facts that contradict the worldview, the inability to update. And I think the best example of this I saw was in a super harmless example called, it's a documentary called Behind the Curve. It's about flat earth believers. And in it, they're doing these experiments to prove that the world is flat at these different conventions. And every time they do it, surprise, surprise, it fails. And they've always got a problem with the methodology and a way to fix it to get the experiment right. They never go, oh, hang on a second, maybe all these years of science is correct. So what drives that? What drives the commitment to sticking to the idea?
So I actually really quite like that documentary because it demonstrated people's real-world experience. And in essence, we saw just that. In psychology, we would call it confirmation bias, whereby our prior beliefs very much govern what we digest in the future. So digest being information. So we look for things that support our prior beliefs. And things that go against it, we are very ready to discredit it for whatever reason, because we, in essence, want to keep our belief system intact. And then we do this across all our beliefs. We do this across, you know, anything that we kind of think about, because to suddenly be changing our minds on things all the time can be it's not a good feeling. So we want to kind of stay with that belief system that we have, which unfortunately means that with conspiracy narratives, someone who believes the world is full of conspiracies and indeed mistrusts those that they perceive to be in power are motivated to, in essence, push back on the official account, to not trust the scientists or the experts because it doesn't fit their worldview. So it is a challenge to try and get someone to think slightly differently because, in essence, it's their social density. It's become who they are. It's maybe who their friends are now. It's their community. So it's in their echo chamber and they're kind of stuck in it, which, yeah, it's hard.
It's funny because I've experienced like both types in a way, because I've seen people that like don't bring it up, but you know it's there, you see it on Facebook, but they don't talk about it with you. But then like, because I don't like conflict on Facebook, I don't like arguing on Facebook, I will not call them out on the comments like, hey, I didn't know you believe this shit. So I just let it go, but I see it in them. On the other hand, I used to work with this guy who I saw him go from like a normal dude to a full-blown flat earther over the course of 6 months. And it was funny how like he went from like, did you hear there's people that actually believe the earth is flat? To, I'm telling you, man, that shit is flat. In like that period of time. But the funny thing about it is like, it's like the other way that you describe of how it becomes their personality. He actually like started like taking pride in arguing against everybody else in the shop, and at one point it was like all the globe theorists saying let's just not bring it up. So I don't know, it was very funny for us to be like, you know what, we should shut up about the earth being round. This guy is not gonna let up.
Wait, so I get that you don't feel comfortable arguing with them on Facebook, but in real life, you were just sitting there listening to him talk about the flat earth and not being like, come on, dude.
We did it. We did argue with it like for a long time, and there was a point where we just gave up. But like if you talk to somebody about it over the course of 6 months and you only see them getting deeper and deeper and deeper into it, to the point where like there's a moment where like he's just not turning back. So we just that's the point where we stopped. I actually enjoyed like talking about it on at the shop. Like I try to find like the different angles with which I could like just like show him he was wrong, or he was like just using like the wrong evidence. Because it's also funny, it's so cartoonish. Like when you meet one of these people in real life, because they are exactly how they are portrayed in memes, like that whole like flat earther starter pack, do your own research, you know, that sort of thing. And it's just like YouTube videos. So
yeah. I have spoken about this before, but I have a couple people in my close circle who I'm having these conversations with at the moment. And I do find it, what you said about it being super comical and cliche is something that I do find really interesting. And do your own research is obviously one that gets thrown around a lot. And I find that super interesting because on the one hand, they'll be like, do your own research. And then when they show you research and you go, okay, but this is why that was wrong. This is why that was wrong. This is why that was wrong. They go, oh, it's so confusing. I can't, oh, there's so much misinformation. And they kind of lean on the misinformation as a way to excuse their bad facts and never evaluate, oh, maybe the reason I'm getting so much misinformation is because I'm going to a factual source that is full of shit. And that's the one hand. But then on the second hand, they're super get it. Like, it is super cliche the amount of people who are like, I'm allowed to have my opinion and of discussion. And it's like, well, if you've got any confidence in that opinion, you may as well throw it up and have a chat about it. Daniel, what are some things you would say if you have to have that conversation with somebody? What's an effective way to do that? How do you argue with somebody who is impervious to facts?
I don't think there is, because like, look at it this way. That documentary you mentioned about the flat earthers, the most interesting fact of it is that the methodologies that they came up with to prove that the earth was flat weren't flawed. Like, the experiments weren't flawed. Like, they worked. They did what they had to do. So, like, these are people that are smart enough to come up with the experiments that will prove whether the Earth is flat or round. And then, like, their own experiments that are actually, like, decent enough as a method, they were like, nah.
Say what you will about flat earthers, they do have scientifically sound methodology.
Yeah.
So I would say, actually, instead of focusing on the specific theory that they believe, to kind of step back and take more of an overarching view of it. Because, of course, if you're trying to argue or rather debate with someone who has a very strong belief about something, that is going to be problematic because they're going to hold on to it heartily. Instead, potentially having more of an open discussion about why they believe what they do. What does it offer them? What is it trying to address? In essence, trying to understand more the psychology of why they've got that point. So they may talk about with COVID that they, you know, well, it's quite anxiety provoking. It's quite, you know, quite uncertain. They may mention some of these traits, which whilst are not about the theory themselves, can maybe help you think, okay, well, this person maybe needs some help, some support in these facets, that if we're able to kind of make someone feel more, I don't know, address some of these needs, it may make them think a little bit more clearly. And indeed, having this kind of more of a compassion talk about why they believe can actually build that trust potentially. So you can argue that, yeah, I also agree it's important to ask questions and to think critically, but it's important to think critically about all evidence. And in essence, encourage them and affirm the values based around critical thinking. So they then start, hopefully, to think more critically about their own beliefs, which can then move into maybe you talking about their specific theory. But if you've built that kind of narrative up front where it's not necessarily on the defence, it could help with that discussion. But I think, in essence, it's really hard to have these discussions. And with interventions more broadly, there's potentially those interventions for the general population who are maybe sceptical, who aren't necessarily sure of what they believe. They're not a hardened conspiracy theorist, but they're asking questions versus someone who is really motivated to defend their beliefs. And potentially the discussions that we have could be slightly different depending on that group. But in essence, I always think about it going in and trying to understand their beliefs and what it offers them, as opposed to trying to debate them on their specific beliefs about the causes of COVID or whatever it is.
So in some ways, you're trying to inception them and make them believe that the questioning of the ideas was their own idea?
I suppose in a way, in essence, kind of affirming their critical thinking abilities, because, you know, it's important to ask questions. Like, we should always ask questions about what is happening in the world. The problem comes when people have this overrun suspicion across any official explanation and that they're immune to evidence, whereby with climate change, highlighting that the consensus says it's happening, but people who believe in climate change push back on that. So in essence, they're asking questions, but are not being able to evaluate the evidence. So we both kind of affirming the skills around critical thinking, that it's important to ask questions, but also to evaluate. It may get them to think more about their beliefs, in essence, their echo chamber. Because of course, we want them to ask questions, but we also want them to evaluate.
So this brings me to two of my biggest confusions around conspiracy theorists, and I'd love to hear both your thoughts on this. So the first one is, you mentioned that the critical belief of every official explanation, and that is one thing that really confuses the shit out of me, is that these conspiracy theories travel in packs. So if I know that you believe in chemtrails, I know you're probably going to disagree with COVID. Or if I know that you believe in QAnon, you probably disagree with climate change. And it just feels like if you're going to have one out there opinion, like these are Hail Mary shots that potentially one of them may be true one day, but it would be one of them. So if you're having 10, one in a million chances, at least 9 of them are wrong, right? And that really confuses the shit out of me. It's like, how do you get so confident disagreeing with everything? Like, if I introduce my name and somebody gives me a funny look, I'm like, is that my name? How are you disagreeing with every factual piece of information? Like, how do you get that confidence?
So if I take it first, I suppose, with the psychology, so it's back to the world views. If I see the world as full of conspiracies that I think there's a cover-up, it makes other conspiracies seem really plausible. And indeed, with one event, there can be multiple conspiracies about that event, where different conspirators are suggested to be involved. And what we know is that if people believe in the more kind of abstract term that conspiracies are happening in our society, they're likely to believe in multiple conspiracies about the same event. Some research found that to do with Diana, people were likely to believe that she was killed by the royal family, whilst at the same time believing that she took her own life as a part of a cover-up. So actually she faked her own death. But of course, someone can't be both dead and alive at the same time. So this kind of adds to that narrative of you kind of maintain your general belief that if I believe something sinister has gone on, I'm happy to endorse kind of similar kind of facets, when actually in reality, both can't be true, which I think kind of builds psychology around, well, actually, it's how we see the world, and we're keen to kind of keep that narrative going. So we are likely to believe in multiple conspiracies about the same event, but also about other events as well. So as you say, if you know someone's belief about COVID, they're very likely to have belief in other types of conspiracies.
I do love the idea that they're just out here like, I don't know what I believe, but I know I don't believe you.
Yeah, in essence, yeah. It's that mistrust. That mistrust builds to such a point that anything someone says, you have this overriding suspicion, which I think is a real key difference with asking questions and being sceptical and then being conspiratorial, because this overriding thing just overrides everything. And you are, unfortunately, seem to be immune to evidence, which I think is really problematic, of course.
I may be oversimplifying this, but it does seem like it all comes down to a lot of mistrust. Is this a case where if people had been more not been let down by their parents in early developmental childhood, we wouldn't have conspiracy theories?
Funny enough, you do say that. Anxiety, a type of parenting based around anxiety does seem to kind of be associated with conspiratorial beliefs in the future. So parenting and, in essence, your prior experiences probably do indeed play a role. So more often than not, for example, people from who are part of minority groups are more likely to believe in conspiracy theories. And we demonstrate in a sample of gay men that those who report prior discrimination because of their sexuality are more likely to believe in conspiracies. In essence, because if you've already received discrimination, if you already had someone there to get you, well, then you're hypervigilant looking out for that in the future. So in essence, our prior experiences of whether it's our parenting, whether it's our discrimination, whether it's, you know, whatever it is, can actually put you in a place where conspiracies seem appealing. It's all based on our prior beliefs, potentially.
That really makes sense to me. especially, I think I've seen like a lot of people go from just like grabbing onto those little things that are like, that we can all agree there's something dodgy happening, and then building up to the earth is flat, like, you know, the JFK assassination or the Jeffrey Epstein death. That's a great recent one where like this dude killed himself in a cell with like whatever, like a couple dodgy circumstances, and that's enough to build into Hillary Clinton came in with like some dental floss and broke his neck. I don't know, like
I get what you're saying in that. And do you know what I find funny about that as well, one, is you're talking about like the JFK assassination, and to some extent Epstein's more modern, but I do feel really weird that I'm now at a point in my life where I'm nostalgic for conspiracy theories that I could at least see the point in. Like, yeah. Like Bush did 9/11. I didn't get on board because like, as much as I understand the questioning of authority and power and all of those things, it's like, if you had all of the resources of the US government, even if you were super incompetent, if you did something dodgy, there is no way that fucking Gavin in his basement is the guy who's cracking that.
Well, I think you're totally right there. And indeed, there are examples of real conspiracies being proven true, but there's only a couple of those examples, and it's always been based around journalists. Journalists asking questions and kind of finding the truth. It's never been, as your example there, someone sat in their basement. It's always been people doing their job, which I think is kind of a key difference, really. And maybe that could help with the conversations with conspiracy theorists, where you kind of acknowledge it's important to ask questions, that real conspiracies have existed, but then talk about how those theories were shown to be true. And that it wasn't the kind of the conspiracy theories per se, it was journalists asking actual questions.
For example, with this QAnon thing, these guys believe there's some dude like deep in the government that like has access to all this information, where we have like the clear example of Edward Snowden, who was a legit whistleblower, but he had to like come out because like there was no way he could reveal that information and nobody in the government would find out it was him. So
he had to flee to Russia.
Yeah, exactly. You cannot just like start leaking on the regular all these like high level classified information without having them find out who you are. So like the even like they don't even grab to like the real life examples we have of some of events like that.
I do love the idea of encouraging these people to interrogate journalism and their belief. I do fear greatly that if we all start doing that, we will create a new generation of Breitbart journalists. So be careful. The Edward Snowden thing one is a really great point. And it is interesting the way the distrust of these things, as you kind of point out, is so specific to their case, but ignores other similar cases. Edward Snowden's one example. The other is the microchips in the vaccines one is another really great example, where these people are like, they're going to track me in microchips in the vaccine. That's what COVID vaccines are about. But it's like, dude, you don't need a tracker anymore. You're posting from Facebook. Snowden talked about this 8 years ago. They know everything they need to know about you. They don't need a fucking microchip.
That's a good point. And I suppose it makes you think about, it depends if you suddenly become part of a conspiracy. So I think a fair example where backwards is in Sandy Hook in America, where it was suggested that it was sort of a false flag, that children died, and it actually didn't happen, that children didn't die, and it was all just covered, it was all just a fake. Somewhat a parent whose child did actually die in this shooting was a conspiracy theorist beforehand. He believed in 9/11, etc., etc. He said he said he was actually, you know, he was very much invested. But then when he, in essence, came part of the conspiracy and people were saying to him that his child didn't exist, that it wasn't a thing, it's all he's part of a false flag, he was like, this actually is true. Like, my child actually did die. Like, what on earth are you on about? And this changed his whole belief system. And in essence, he was able to see, well, actually, these theories are just not real, because I'm suddenly part of a conspiracy that didn't actually happen. Like, this actually is true. And it changed his whole outlook. And indeed, he spoke to a whole different journalist. He wrote things down and he tried to talk about, in essence, that, you know, he's come to the other side, that being a part of this journey and being seen to be a conspiracy changed his whole outlook on life. And of course, that's not one way to kind of to de-radicalize someone, to be part of a conspiracy. But in essence, it kind of highlights how people maybe need to kind of speak to those who they perceive to be conspiring. So, for example, we have data that demonstrates that if you have positive contact with a Jewish person, you're less likely to believe in Jewish conspiracy theories, because you're able to kind of speak to someone and kind of have that relationship. So potentially, if you're able to speak to, thinking about people in the government and actually, in essence, learn about the government and how it's not just one entity, because, of course, when someone suggests that the government is involved in conspiracy theories, it's always the government in a very broad sense. But of course, the government is very big and it's very clunky and there's so many parts to it. So if you're able to understand the makeup of the government and in essence meet, you know, people from the government, it may change their kind of viewpoint on whether the conspiracy actually is plausible in essence.
I don't know, man. My flat earther friend was Brazilian and he was living in Australia and he got on planes all the time.
fair point.
I think what you just said makes a lot of sense, but at the same time, I'm not that hopeful.
I do think one of the things that you mentioned that I think is worth touching on is the fact that these anti, like the Sandy Hook conspiracy theorists, were actually going to the houses of the victims. And this is something I find super interesting in terms of conspiracy theories are one of those things that, like, they're fun to, I think they're fucking fun to point fun at from the distance as a kind of like, oh my God, how novel and ridiculous that these people believe these things. But increasingly, we are seeing people who believe these things and connect on the internet then going out and acting upon that in real life. How dangerous are conspiracy theories and how dangerous can the impacts of their spread be societally?
I think that's a great question. And I think just from our conversation, we've highlighted how, in essence, anyone can be a conspiracy theorist in a way, because they're kind of, they breed off our kind of anxieties, which means that anyone can kind of fall trap into these kind of belief systems, that it can happen really quickly. But they can have a real world impact, whereby there's many, many, many unfortunate examples of violence being linked with conspiratorial beliefs, because people believe the government or a larger group, whoever it is involved in these conspiracies against them. They want to call them out on that, in essence, try and stop them. And there's been empirical evidence to suggest the same links, that people who believe in conspiracy theories are more accepting of violent extremism. So that means going to a legal protest and that would turn violent, fighting with the police. And indeed, I have data that highlights the link between 5G conspiracy beliefs and also the acceptance of violence towards the telecoms industry. So in essence, that they'd be willing to set alight to pylons, that they would be violent towards telecom workers. And we found that these links were potentially explained by anger. So there was some associations with belief in conspiracy theories and feelings of anger, which then may lead them to acting in this violent way. Which kind of makes sense, that the conspiracy kind of makes you feel really angry about what's happening, so you want to go out there and actually call them out on that. And also we found that the link between anger and violence was more pronounced if you're paranoid. So in essence, the conspiracy could make you feel more angry. And if you already have kind of this personality variable to kind of, in essence, be paranoid, you're then more likely to go out and actually want to do these acts. So in one hand, it's not that everyone who believes in a conspiracy is going to be more violent, for example. Rather, it's a bit more complex than that. But it does highlight the links between the two. But of course, there are other kind of more other serious behaviours. It's not just violence. Those who believe in conspiracies are less likely to want to vaccinate because they believe vaccines are dangerous. Those who believe in conspiracies are less likely to want to follow advice of the government, which means that they're less likely to follow COVID advice. So to do with self-isolation or wearing masks, because they don't want to follow the normative context. They don't want to follow what the government is saying. Instead, they prefer to follow the alternatives, the things that are non-normative. So, for example, going to protests, using other medicines that are not necessarily pushed by the government. So right back, you know, at the start of COVID, there was a whole range of different alternative medicines that were being encouraged to be taken as a way to stop COVID. And those who believed in conspiracies were more likely to use these alternatives because they're inbuilt, in essence, to kind of push back on authority. So yes, I do think conspiracy theories can be very dangerous. And with violence, there are links, but it is quite a complex relationship. Not everyone who believes in conspiracies will act in this way, which I think makes sense to me. You know.
That being said, if you are a violent, paranoid conspiracy theorist listening to this podcast, everything all three of us have said has been said with love. We believe you fully. The truth is out there.
and I think with that said, I think there are people who have these beliefs and, of course, who are motivated, who are very aggressive online. There's a BBC reporter who his role is, in essence, is on conspiracy narratives and misinformation, and she gets so much abuse online, it's insane. And indeed, there's a whole, even us as psychologists, there's a whole host of scholars who get regular, in essence, abuse in emails and tweets. So with that said, in a joke, it actually does happen that people are increasingly aggressive towards people who are part of the media and part of the scientific community, because in essence they distrust us. So it kind of makes it acceptable to act in this way, which is obviously really problematic.
How dare you, Daniel, with your facts and your fancy degrees, come and correct me? But as somebody in psychology who has to empathize with, I guess to effectively do your job, you have to understand where these motivations and anxieties and all of that develops. How difficult is that to do when, are you dealing with conspiracy theorists more, and how difficult is it to empathize with somebody whose worldview is so shifted from your own reality?
Yeah, it is challenging, of course, and having these conversations is really challenging. But I do think it's really important to still have those conversations and, in essence, try and be empathetic towards why that person is at that point. So I think it helps, at least in my view, of course, not othering them and not, in essence, ostracizing them or seeing them as weird and wacky, because they may have found themselves this conspiracy narrative as a way to understand a very complex world, which is all something that we're all trying to do. So in essence, trying to see them as that other human, trying to understand their beliefs, kind of helps with that. But with all that said, I fully appreciate how trying to engage with someone who has a very different view to you is really challenging. And there's no easy answer for that, really.
Juan, how are you trying to explain a complex world? What's the closest you've got to conspiracy?
Well, you know, like the thing is, I had like this very personal experience because I declared myself an atheist when I was six, and then I was sent over to a Catholic school until I finished high school. But like they were cool, like that the school was fine, like they weren't pushing it on me, but they were aware that that was like my belief, let's say. But they weren't too pushy. I obviously went through the angsty, edgy, douchey atheist phase when I was like 16 or something, and eventually came out like the other way, like being more zen about it. Like, yeah, man, like you do you as long as you're not an asshole. But I don't know, I feel like that put me in a headspace where I'm like, yeah, nobody really knows what's going on, so we all, you know, try to do what, like, go with what's best for our level of comfort. But sometimes I've seen like a lot of people with different beliefs, and like I've learned to know which ones are like, okay, this guy's okay, and this guy's a crazy person. Because I hate atheists, for example. I've had a lot of atheist people like find out I'm an atheist, and they're like, oh, bro, we should talk about Richard Dawkins all the time. And I'm like, nah, man, I didn't get into this to read a book, you know? It's again like... So, I don't know, man. Like, I, for example, like this whole political division that you see in America right now between the two parties and all of that, that's been going on in Argentina since forever. My parents would qualify as like sort of like the Reagan Republicans sort of version of, you know, the Argentinian version of that, and I've seen them like argue with people and like dehumanize an entire segment of the population because of their political beliefs, and then seen the other side do the same. So I feel like I've become kind of a coward in that sense. Like, I don't want to argue with like people with that hold too strong beliefs, and I much rather have sort of meta conversations such as this one about the way that beliefs work themselves, rather than discuss the beliefs, you know?
This podcast is absolutely an exercise in privilege in that we get to academically look at something that affects people in real life from the comfort of positions where it is unlikely to impact us.
Yeah, 100%. But for example, like, I do enjoy watching that, but sometimes I'm horrified. Like, I follow a couple, you know, political pundits on Facebook, like a very prominent right-wing one. And it's funny because, like, sometimes I'll go into the comments and, like, he will post, like, some article from his site about how, like, this new vaccine is only happening because of Trump, right? And this is, like, a very sycophantic Trump fan. And then you go into the comments and, like, half the comments are like, oh, my God, thank God for President Trump. He's the best president ever. And then the other half are like, I'm sorry, bro, but, like, I'm not getting any vaccines. I know Trump has to say that the vaccine is going to work, but I'm not into vaccines. And I know he doesn't believe in vaccines, and he's just saying it to on the lips. And I'm like, you know, so I don't know. I'm very discouraged right now.
I do think if there is one thing that is nothing if not impressive, it is the absolute commitment, like the absolute belief in the own ideas is something that is enviable. Like, oh my God, you really do know how to stick to it.
I mean, yeah. It is incredible how you can kind of stay in that kind of belief system. And in a way, it may be kind of comforting in a way to kind of have your identity and that. Well, we do know that people who believe in conspiracies say they feel a part of a community of those who are like-minded of them, which I'm sure can be quite empowering. Of course, I would argue the more broader things is that it's probably not as satisfying, that they may seem appealing, as I've talked about, but actually they're not necessarily satisfying because they kind of increase your mistrust, increase your anxiety. Okay, you may feel a community with those who are like-minded, but you potentially could try and get that community via other sources, other hobbies, other things. So these motives can be addressed by other things. I think conspiracy theories are certainly here to stay, and of course, they're not going to go away, but it's important that we do talk about them. So in a way, it's kind of good that the media are talking about them so much. And they're not talking about them, at least in my view, in a very negative way. It's more of a way of trying to say these exist and here's the potential outcomes that could have. So these COVID beliefs may be linked with actual disengagement. That actually is a concern. They're not necessarily othering these conspiracy theorists, but rather trying to kind of highlight the dangers, in essence, of these narratives, potentially.
I do think the point you make about it not being satisfying is a really interesting one in terms of the way it breeds more distrust and breeds more feelings of anxiety. Because just anecdotally, from the people I know who I've seen gradually increase their engagement in these theories, what you get is this, it's almost like a descent into addiction, where you get, as Juan said with the flat earther to begin with as well, like this kind of humoring of the idea and then an acceptance of small amounts of facts until the point where you are so bombarded in, I'm assuming in your digital echo chamber, but then also fostering social groups that is all about this anxiety that you have, to the point that you are A, having arguments with people in your real life social circles and losing friends there, and then replacing those friendships with people who are distrustful and angry. It would make for a sad life.
I would argue that it's also like a weird thing to build an identity around, because, for example, I'm a huge Kanye West fan, right? And sometimes if I'm like drunk, I will start going on these rants about how he's the greatest artist of all time, right? But it's not who I am. It's just like something that happens when I'm drunk, you know. But like,
Juan, dye your hair blue if you're gonna have a cheap identity.
Yeah, no. But like, my whole point is like, then like you see these people that like live their lives I just identifying as a fan of an artist, or for example in Argentina there's like people that just live for football, and now like especially now that Maradona just died and like they're destroying half the country because the god is dead over there. But it's funny to me because, like, I mean, you can be the whatever guy in a group of friends when you don't have a personality and you have to invent yourself one because you have nothing going on. Why can't you just be the woodworking guy that's like kind of boring because he's always talking about tools and like what the fuck even is it? You know, I don't know what I've never seen that tree, but like he keeps talking about it as the best like sort of wood for like, I don't know, a cutting board or whatever. I don't know, man. Like, you could do it about anything, but it's such a weird thing to build an identity about, like these very stressful things, because you're all the time thinking that everybody around you is lying to you, and like the people that are not lying to you are believing the lie, and they're fucking idiots, and you are like so alone in this world except for your little internet friends. I don't know. It just seems sad.
Dude, I absolutely love the idea that the solution to conspiracy theorists being radicalized is just the minute they share their first dodgy meme, you come over with a chopping board, a sander, and a saw, and like, have a go at this. This will change your life.
No, but like, just think about it. Like, for example, so a lot of these people, they also may just want attention. You know, like if you're not a particularly charismatic person, and you cannot hold a conversation about the weather that seems completely enthralling, then maybe you just like start bringing that shit up to like try to get some sort of reaction. So I don't know, maybe like the next time that you find like that you're talking to a flat earther and then like he mentions something that has nothing to do with conspiracy theories, like, yeah, the other way I went to a run, and then you're like, oh my god, I love running too, and then like some like try to give him like some positive feedback on other topics, so he may be like, oh, maybe I should like drop the flat earth guy thing and be like the runner guy, you know. I don't know.
I love the idea that there are conspiracy theorists out there listening to this podcast going, see, I told you, they're trying to socially engineer us with positive reinforcement.
I do quite like that. Be the runner guy. I like that. Be the runner guy.
Yeah.
Has there been any research, Daniel, into the idea of early intervention and steering people into hobbies as a way to fill their time and sense of community?
I'm surprised to say no, actually. No. and you know, I do think it's probably some slight, I can kind of see some slight merit in that, trying to have that conversation and ask, in essence, what does this conspiracy offer to you? What is it trying to address? And maybe highlighting, well, actually, it's just furthering your anxieties, furthering you feeling ostracized. So focusing on different hobbies to kind of help your kind of coping mechanisms may be a nice step forward. I suppose just thinking how best to actually have those conversations and what it would look like. But no research exactly into this. But I certainly can see potential in it, potentially.
You heard it on the podcast first. Woodworking will save the world.
We'll save the world. Be the runner guy.
To be honest, I know a few of my runner guy friends who I'd almost prefer they spoke about conspiracy theories.
Well, I don't know, man. I've been the keto guy for a while. That was like really annoying to a lot of my friends. I imagine if I had been the anti-vaxxer guy, they would have enjoyed my company a lot more during that time. I also got really into intermittent fasting for that same period, so I was like really obnoxious.
I guess this is a good point to ask, just round the room, what is the craziest conspiracy theory you've heard? Start with you, Juan, and then Daniel, I'm sure as part of your research, you've probably been exposed to some wild ones.
Yeah. Okay, I'll go just to, because I've like overplayed the Argentinian card on this episode. But this is my absolute favorite one, and it's from back home. I went to Buenos Aires. I'm not from Buenos Aires, but I went to Buenos Aires one time, and I grabbed a cab. And taxi drivers in Buenos Aires are like very well known for like talking a lot of shit. So this one taxi driver told me that Elvis isn't dead. That the reality is that Elvis Presley had a long lost twin brother that he managed to track down, and he found him, and the guy was just as good looking as him and could sing just as well as him and could dance just as well as him, and Elvis was like done with the fame and that life. So he was like, hey man, do you want to take over for me as Elvis and be the new Elvis? And that's the guy that got addicted to pills and like fucking ruined his life and died on the toilet. The real Elvis, the cool Elvis, the original Elvis, is driving a taxi in Buenos Aires and has a barbecue with this guy every other weekend.
Oh, wait. That's not even a conspiracy theory at this point. That's just a guy who's been tricked.
Maybe. I don't know, man. But it's just my favorite, and I've told it to like everybody that will listen because I just love it.
I was thinking something similar in my favorites are always based around some celebrity has died and has been replaced by a lookalike. And there's actually different celebrities that have suggested this has happened to, like Paul McCartney, Avril Lavigne, have all been suggested that they've died and been replaced, which I always think is really fascinating. But I suppose actually my ultimate favourite is that I asked a group of like 16-year-olds what theories do they know of, and someone put their hand up and said that Beyonce is a robot, which... I've never heard that one before. And so I gave it a quick Google. And indeed, Google Images has a lot of pictures of Beyonce being a robot. And people pointing at things saying, look, here you can see this, here you see that. Fascinating.
Do love the absolute simplicity of that one as well. Because yeah. Clearly what's happened is somebody's gone, Beyonce's a hit machine. And somebody else has gone, you're right.
So in essence, one's about celebrities doing weird things, such as being dead, replaced, or being a robot. I've just kind of ones that kind of make me laugh.
My favourite thing about the Avril Lavigne one in particular is that rose to like the height of its popularity about 4 or 5 years after the height of her fame.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
What even is the point?
Yeah, exactly. It's just people speculating over stuff that literally has no impact to anything. My favorite, which I'm surprised wasn't brought up, but I'm thrilled that I get to raise, is I once went into a very long Twitter thread from a group of conspiracy theorists that believe the world ended in 2012 when CERN started the Hadron Collider. And we are living in like the black hole of that disaster event. Wow. And that's why everything's been weird ever since.
Wow. I've not heard of that one. That is a new, wow. Okay. Wow.
That one's pretty great.
It is as a piece of like compelling narrative fiction, it is an absolute masterpiece, because the selective bits of evidence they've put over the last, well, at this point, 8 years, is absolutely amazing. And they've got photos of I guess the Mandela effect, right, where there's these communal misrememberings since 2012. And obviously these things happen around big events all the time, but they've selected and laid them out in a narrative that all suggests that this is all because in 2012 the world ended, and the black hole simulation that we're in is an imperfect copy of the world before 2012.
Bro, that's absolutely amazing.
How I'm do you explain 2020 and all the things that have gone wrong in 2020? How does that? What? Someone's planned 2020. Jeez.
I guess what their theory, because their whole thing is that it is an imperfect simulation as the Earth is ending. I guess if you were to take their lens on it, the 2020 would be an acceleration of the divergence, right? And things are getting further and further away from
what it.
I think 2020 would buy in, like would support their message. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
That is amazing. One. I had never heard that before.
Yeah. Great.
I think if nothing else, I think it is a great thing for everybody to research, because it is fascinatingly dumb, as in terms of like, this is ridiculous and there's no way it could ever be true, but it's a great example of the way a narrative can be constructed out of isolated incidents.
Yeah,
that's beautiful.
That is great. Thanks for sharing that one. I really enjoyed that one.
I'm actually just not gonna pay attention anymore, because I'm gonna start googling that collider thing. I'm happy that you brought it up at the end, because otherwise I would have been gone for the entire podcast if it came up early.
Brilliant.
And that's it. If you have enjoyed the episode, please, it would mean a lot if you give me a positive review on iTunes or share this podcast with a friend. If you haven't, or if there is something you'd like to see, any feedback, please feel free to get in touch with me on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. I'd love to hear your feedback and get to know what the listeners like and don't like. Thanks, and I'll talk to you again soon.